We are going to be studying the end of Sefer Bereishit today, this morning. I just want to reiterate what I think Rav Willig said in our Tehillim, that although we're not learning about Eretz Yisrael and the situation going on in Eretz Yisrael, we obviously should view our shiur as hopefully this food and the merit of our learning should be an extra protection for our soldiers. I want to welcome my mother, who's here. Last time I spoke, my mother was unfortunately away, and I remarked that it was kind of funny that she comes all the time, and the one week that I was giving Midrash Yom Rishon, she was away in L.A., so it's nice that she's back. Although, unfortunately, my mother-in-law, who came last time, she broke her shoulder, and she can't be here this morning, so I can't get it straight with my weeks. I think next time we'll get both of them here. I think most of us love the end of Sefer Shemot. I'm teaching Sefer Shemot this year, so I keep talking about it. I think we all love the end of Bereishit. It's a very exciting story with Yosef and his brothers, a lot of drama. I know on Shabbos when I'm teaching the stories to my 4-year-old daughter, she can't wait for the next week because she's so excited what's going to happen next. It's a very exciting story. And I think we normally view the last several prakim of Sefer Bereishit as one unified story. And very often it has a title called Sipurei Yosef, the stories of Yosef. From Parsha Vayeshev until Parsha Vayechi, the Torah gives us a very long, detailed account of the life of Yosef, beginning with his slavery and his sale into slavery into Egypt until his long-awaited reunion with his family. Nachum Sarna, in his book on Genesis, he writes that apart from the Yehuda and Tamar story and Yaakov's farewell blessing to his sons, the rest of the book of Genesis is devoted to the story of Yosef, chapters 37 through 50. Which means all the last 13 chapters of Bereishit are all about Yosef, but we have two hiatus stories. We have the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and we have the story of Berachat Yaakov, which don't fit into the life and narrative of Yosef. While I do not deny that this portrayal is valid, I think there is another, more coherent perhaps way of viewing these last 13 chapters of Bereishit. So I want to quickly summarize what happens in these prakim. So that's what we're going to do first. We're going to look through sources 1 through 9 pretty quickly, get a refresh of what happens at the end of Sefer Bereishit. Okay, beginning with Perek Lamed Zayin, our first source. The story begins with Yaakov's family intact. That's Pasuk Aleph, Vayeshev, Yaakov, Eretz Megurei Avi, Eretz Canaan. And we're told, Ela Toldos Yaakov, Yosef, Ben Sheva, Esrei Shana. We're told about the family living together in Israel. We're told about conflict and there's inner struggle within the family. Yosef is the favored son. The Achim, the brothers, despise this. And there's a lot of animosity brewing. And the end of Perek Lamed Zayin, we end up with Yosef being sold from one group to another, from the Ishmaelim to the Midianim. Finally, he ends up Pasuk Lamed Vav, the Midianim Machru Otel El Mitzrayim LePotifar Sris Paro Sar Tavachim. Yosef ends up in the house of Potifar in Mitzrayim. Perek Lamed Chet, what we viewed as our hiatus in our story, we talk about Yehuda. Yehuda leaves his family. We're told in Pasuk Aleph, this is source number 2, Perek Lamed Chet, Vayhi Ba'etahi Vayered Yehuda Me'etachav. Yehuda leaves his brothers. And we're told that Yehuda marries somebody, a Canaanite woman, which was usually taboo in the family, but the Torah doesn't make any comments here about it. He has 3 sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. We're told that he gets a wife for his oldest son. Her name is Tamar. His eldest son dies. Then he gives Tamar to his second son, and his second son dies, and then Yehuda thinks, wow, we've got this bad luck girl in the family. He lies to Tamar. He tells Tamar, just wait till the youngest son, Shelah, gets a little bit older, and I'll give you him to marry. He has no intention of doing so, as the Torah tells us. He's scared what would happen to his third son, and Tamar is sick of waiting. She dresses herself up as a prostitute. She goes out to the crossroads. Yehuda does not know who she is. He has a relationship with her, unknowing it's Tamar. And later on, when he finds that Tamar is pregnant, he decides to have her killed. This is now the next page. Hotzioa v'tisareth. She should be taken out and be burnt. And before Tamar is killed, she says, whoever recognizes the seal, the cloak, the staff. He is the one who is the father of my children. Yehuda realizes this, and he does not have her killed, and he says that she is more righteous than I am. And that's where the story basically ends, and we're told that she gives birth to two children, Peretz and Zerah, who will be the forefathers of the Malchut, of kingship. Perek Lamed Tet describes how Yosef, what happens to Yosef now that he's in Mitzrayim. So Perek Lamed Tet is now Yosef in the house of Potiphar, and it's the whole story where Aisha Potiphar, his master's wife, is not so moral. She keeps trying to seduce Yosef. Yosef does not succumb, does not fall, but one day there is no one else at home. They are alone. She tries again to make her move. Yosef runs outside. She's holding the garment. She makes up a whole lie, and she frames Yosef. The parak ends where Yosef is placed in jail, Beit HaSohar, and again, he finds favor with the Sar Beit HaSohar, the warden, the person in charge of the jail, and he goes up the ranks of prison life. Perek Mem is Yosef, what happens to Yosef in Beit HaSohar, with the story of the Sar HaMashkim and Sar HaOfim, the butler and the baker. Source number 5, we have Paro's dreams and Yosef's appointment as Mishal HaMelech. And the end of our Perek, again, a lot of these sources, I cut out a lot of the middle ground because obviously then it would just be like 10 pages of source sheets. At the end of source number 5, we're told that the Ra'av begins in Eretz Mitzrayim, and people come down now to buy food. So that leads us back to our next part, Perek Mem Bet. Yosef's brothers go down to buy food. Shimon is imprisoned. Yaakov refuses to send Binyamin, or the brothers were obviously framed as being spies. Source number 7, Yaakov finally agrees to send out Binyamin because the food has run out of the family. We're told v'ha'ra'av kaved ba'aretz, and there's nothing left. And Yaakov finally agrees to send down Binyamin only after Yehuda makes a passionate plea and guarantees to protect and take care of Binyamin. In Perek Mem Dalet, Binyamin is framed. This is and then Yehuda gives this very, very passionate speech. This was last week's parsha by Yigash, where there are a lot of messages on the surface. He's being very sophisticated, and he's beseeching the king or a noble to be fair with him. On the Midrash points out that under the surface he's being very tough to Yosef, but uses a lot of imagery about an elderly, aged father, a very young boy. He keeps referring to Binyamin as a hana'ar. You would think Binyamin's this tiny little like kid. He's probably, we actually know, he already has several children at this point. He's much older. But he's trying to invoke a passion response by the Mishnah Lamelech. And finally, in Perek Memhei, Yosef finally breaks down, and he tells the brothers who he is, with the famous response, Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avi Chai, and which leads to our next Sevukim, where the family is now going to be reunited. The story ends exactly where it began. The family is now intact again. Just like in Perek Lamed Zayin, the family unit was together, so too, in Perek Mem Vav, Yaakov and his entire family are going to go down to Mitzrayim. They're all going to be together again. This time, though, it's after 22 years of separation. And this time, there's no internal struggle and tension. But this time, the family is no longer in Eretz Yisrael. Now the family has been relocated to Mitzrayim. I believe that looking at the story, we've just summarize all the stories. I believe that the story, we should not view it as Sipurei Yosef, but rather we should view this as Sipurei Yosef v'Yehuda. The Torah is concerned with two characters, not just one. This is not just the life and trials of Yosef through slavery and how he moves up ranks, and the family back in Israel is on the side. Rather, the Torah cares deeply and equally about these two characters, Yosef and Yehuda. And the Torah gives us each one of their independent stories a detailed account. So Perek Lamed Chet, let's go back even earlier. So Perek Lamed Zayin is about the family together. Yosef and Yehuda, and they're the two main characters there. Yosef is the victim, he's the one who's being sold, but Yehuda is the perpetrator. It's his idea to sell Yosef. Right? It's his idea of the brothers, let's not touch him, let's not kill him, ma besa, what will we gain from this? Let's sell him to Mizraim. Then the Torah discusses Yehuda's story in isolation. That was Perek Lamed Chet. After the Torah has discussed Yehuda's story in isolation, then the Torah goes to describe Yosef's story by itself. Those are Prakim Lamed Tet through Mem Aleph. Then these characters will meet again, and their lives will merge, although unknowingly for Yehuda, because he does not realize Yosef's identity. This occurs in Prakim Mem Bet through Mem Dalet. Until finally, in Perek Mem Hei, because of Yehuda's passionate speech, Yosef will admit his identity, and then these character stories merge again for us to stay further together. Not only does the Torah decide to write independent stories of these two characters, but the Torah, in a very beautiful way, describes their lives as mirror images of one another. Perek Lamed Ched and Perek Lamed Ted. Perek Lamed Ched and the rest of the stories about Yosef, so Perek Lamed Zion and then Lamed Ted through Mem Aleph. A lot of recurring words and a lot of recurring motifs are found by both these two characters. Therefore, we can conclude that Perek Lamed Ched is not an intermission to the plot, but rather it's a simultaneous plot with striking similar plot lines to the Yosef story. So we're going to be comparing Perek Lamed Ched, the story of Yehuda and Tamar, to the rest of the stories that we know as about Yosef. The first striking, and this is something that the Midrash comments on, is the word vayarei. Perek Lamed Ched begins, vayhi ba'etahi vayarei Yehuda me'etachav. It was at that time that Yehuda left his brothers. But the Torah uses the word of shoresh of yarad, a yirida, a descent. And the Midrash comments, this is source number... Source number 10. Vayhi va'etahi lo hayatzarif kriyale mimor ela vayyosef hurai mitzrayma. We don't need this whole parak. We should just be told the continuation of our story, and Yosef was brought down to Mitzrayim. Why do I have the story about Yehuda interrupting our rest of the story? Ubipnei mahesmich parsha zulazu. Why is the story of Yehuda leaving placed right next to the story of Yosef? Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Elazar, Omer. Kedei lesmoch yirida leyirida. The Torah wants to connect the descent of Yosef with the descent of Yehuda. So if you look at Perek Lamed Ket, when the Torah now will continue Yosef's personal story, how does Perek Lamed Ket begin? The Yosef who rad Mitzrayim. Yosef went down to Mitzrayim, the same shoresh of Yerida. So just like Yosef is having a Yerida, a descension, he's going away, he's leaving, so too Yehuda himself personally, he's leaving and he's having his personal Yerida. The Midrash notes another similarity. Actually, before we do the rest of the Midrash, there's another Yerida as well. Even before we get to Perek Lamed Ched, if you look at the last two psukim of Perek Lamed Zion, Yaakov says a very similar comment. Yaakov says, when his sons try to comfort him about the loss of Yosef, Yaakov says, Vayomer ki eireid el bini avel sheola. I'm going down to my grave. But again, ki eireid. Yaakov is having a psychological descent. He's mourning. Likewise, Yehuda and Yosef have physical descents in the story, in their personal lives. The Midrash notices another common similar word found by the Yosef story and the Yehuda story. The Midrash, go back to source number 10, says, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Kedei lesmoch hakerna. The Torah wants to connect the two times this phrase hakerna is being used. So where is this phrase hakerna being used in the story of Yosef? So back to Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Bet. The brothers, when they go to Yaakov with the bloodstained coat, so actually my daughter said to me, Mommy, the brothers took Yosef's coat and they really put it in ketchup. I don't know where she learned that from. But Vayishlachu et ketonet hapasim ve'eviu al avihem. They took the famous multicolored coat, they brought it to their father, and they say, Zot matzanu. This is what we found. Hakerna hakotenet bincha hi imlo. They don't say, Yosef's dead, we found him on the road. He's missing. But rather they say, do you recognize this coat of your son? Yes or no? Or do you recognize Yosef's trademark, Hakerna? Likewise, the very famous part of Yehuda's story, right before Tamar is about to be taken out to be burnt because of Yehuda's decree that she should be killed, what does she say? This is Pasuk Chaf Hei in Perek Lamed Ched. This is page 3. Right? V'hi shalcha al hameha. She sends word to her father-in-law, Leimor la'ish asher eila lo anochli hara. Whoever is the owner of these items, he is the one who made me pregnant. But Tomar, Hakerna, Lenmi Hakotem, Vahapitzili, Mahamata Eila. Recognize whoever is the owner of this seal, of the cloak, and of the staff, he is the father. Hakerna. So both these stories, and I think Hakerna is found very infrequently in Tanakh. I think it's only found by these two places, if I'm not mistaken. Likewise, more similar words. We already have yarad, that's our one. Number two is hakerna. Three, gedi'izim. The same animal is found as a prominent place in both the stories. The brothers use the blood of the goat to dip Yosef's cloak in. And likewise, Yehuda wants to pay the woman who he went to, the prostitute, with gedi'izim. He sends his friends out the very next day to find this woman and to repay her. And he tries, and what does he give as payment? Gedi'izim, the same animal, goats. The shorash of Nechama, this is now our fourth one, of comfort is found by both stories. Yaakov, we're told, at the end of Perek Lamed Zayin, Vayima Aimli Hitznathayim. Yaakov cannot gain comfort. He is not consoled by the loss of Yosef. He has no closure. He can't be consoled. While Yehuda and Pasuk Yebet were told after many days after his wife died, Bathsheba, we're told by Yenachem Yehuda. Yehuda does gain comfort. So we have the shorash of Nechama by both stories. And last, this is something that many people comment, Nachum Starna comments a lot, that the word shalach, sending, appears throughout both these stories, multiple times. Throughout Yehuda's story, he's sending things, he's trying to send things to Tamar, to the woman, not knowing, Vayishlach Yehuda, he tries to send the goats, he can't find her. His friend says, Shalachti, I tried to find her, but I couldn't find her. I'm sending. Likewise, throughout Yosef's story, from the very beginning to the very end, someone's being sent. So in Perek Lamed Zayin, Yosef is being sent from Emek Chavron to his brothers to return back word to Yaakov. Reuven says, don't send a handsome, al tishlachu boyad, right? Don't touch him. And they send the cloak to Yaakov, Vayishlachu et keton et hapasin. They send the cloak to Yaakov, trying to give him the word of Yosef. So again, the word shalach. And then most importantly, Yosef himself says at the very end of the story, don't think, says his brothers, don't think you sent me. Don't think it was all you. But really, rather, God sends me, shalach, the mechiyat, to provide for the family. He realizes this divine inspiration and divine plan behind the scenes the whole time, even though God's name is never really mentioned in the last few prakim of Sefer Bereishit. Besides these textual similarities, we've already done five, there are many thematic similarities as well between the Yosef and Yehuda story. So for one, clothing has a very prominent role in both of these two characters' lives. Yosef certainly, where does everything begin? With the ketonet pasim. That seems to be a source of contention and really what seems to bother the brothers about Yosef from the very beginning. And then likewise, in Yosef's story with Asha Potiphar, What she's able to use as her alibi and be able to frame Yosef is his garment, which was left in her hands. So the idea of clothing. And so too, with Perek Lamed Chet, with Yehuda, we're told that Tamar takes off her big day amunata. This is Pasuk Yudal. She takes off her widowed garments, right? Because she was supposed to be waiting for Sheila. She was waiting as a widow until she would marry the third son. So she takes off those garments, and she puts on new garments as a way of disguising herself. And so too, what did Yehuda give her as an erevon, a collateral? He gave her his pitilecha, his cloak, his coat. So we have clothing within both the stories of Yosef and Yehuda. Another thematic similarity is the idea of separation from family. Yosef is separated from his family. Likewise, in whole Perek Lamed Chet, Yehuda is separated from his family. Yes, he goes back to his family at some point, because we know the rest of the story. He's back with his brothers. He goes down with his rest of his brothers to buy food, but in Perek Lamed Chet, he's by himself. We don't have any mention of anyone else in the family. No, there's no time at all. It has to take place within, probably 20 years, but yeah, we're not getting any framework. It had to be enough time where he has three children, they grow up old enough to get married, so we're talking probably around 20-something years, but not more than that, because Yosef is only gone for 22 years. Then we're told, then another thematic similarity is the death of a child. Yaakov is living these 22 years thinking Yosef is dead, but Yehuda actually experienced the death of two children. His eldest and his second son both died. In Yosef and Yehuda's lives, there is a seduction story. Yehuda goes to the prostitute, unknowingly as Tamar, and Asha Potiphar tries to seduce Yosef. Another thematic similarity are disguises. In both of their lives, people use disguises as a way of camouflaging themselves. Yosef disguises himself to the brothers. We're told that he recognizes them, but he makes sure that they will not recognize Yosef. And then the Farshim comment, maybe he covered his face when he spoke to them, or he spoke very harshly, but he did something on purpose to make himself be disguised. They will not recognize him. While in the Yehuda story, who disguises herself? Tamar. She gets dressed up as a way of making sure that Yehuda will not recognize her. Another similarity, lying. Lying occurs in both these stories. Yosef, the Achim lie to Yaakov about Yosef's whereabouts and that what happened to Yosef. And likewise, Yehuda is the one who lies to Tamar. He tells her he's going to give her Shelah, his youngest child, and he has no intention of doing so. He doesn't plan to have her marry his third son. Again, he views her as his bad luck girl. He's just having her wait there in the house. He has no intention at all of having her marry his youngest son. Another similarity is we have people awaiting death row in both stories. We have the Sahar Ofim and Sahar Mashkim who are waiting in jail, awaiting their fate, and Sahar Ofim will be killed. He is on death row. Who is in death row in the Yehuda story? Tamar. She's awaiting her fate. She's about to be burned. And our last similarity is we have an overprotective father for a youngest sibling, for his youngest child. Yaakov, throughout a theme running throughout the rest of the stories, is how concerned he is for Binyamin. He's so scared to set Binyamin down because how could he lose it? How could he lose Binyamin? And when Yehuda, in his passionate speech, what he keeps talking about, if Binyamin, when you divide up Yehuda's speech in Parsha Vayigash, which really could divide in three parts, but in every single part of Yehuda's speech, Yehuda keeps mentioning, if Binyamin goes down, our father will die. That will happen. Right? Our father is so worried about Binyamin. And so too, Yehuda is so worried about his son Shelah, which is why he doesn't want to have him be married off to the, I don't know, is there a phrase, widower maker? Widow? I don't know. We have widow maker, but I don't know if we have it for the man. A man killer? A black what? Black widow, okay. I don't know about it. Again, I mean, the simple answer would be that this is pre-halakha. I don't know. I don't know if that's halakha. I don't know if that's halakha or just, you know, are talking about bad luck. Okay. So we see a lot of similarities. The Torah describes the stories of Yosef with the story of Yehuda. They really lead very parallel lives. They both go through the almost the same similar events throughout the course of these prakim. So why does the Torah care about these two characters? Why does the Torah devote the last 13 chapters to the lives of Yosef and Yehuda? It's not that the Torah cares about these two brothers because it likes them the most, but rather, it's telling us the theme of the last 13 chapters of Sefer Bereishit. And the theme is, who will be the next leader? Right? This is a theme that runs throughout the Bereishit as a whole. We want to find out who's going to be the leader. Right? Bechira and Zichia, God's choosing, God's rejecting. And within the sons of Yaakov, there's a huge competition. We have 12 children here. Who's going to be the next leader of the family, carry on the tradition of the Avot, fulfill the brachot that were given to the Avot, and carry on the next stage of Jewish history? And it's a very, very deep competition between Yosef and Yehuda. The race is on. Yosef seems to be victorious from the onset, doesn't he? He's the favored one. He gets a special coat. You kind of think that obviously Yaakov is kind of voting and, you know, rallying for Yosef. And although Yosef's story takes him to many, many different places throughout his life, he goes to many different locales and a lot of different strata of society. He goes from Yaakov's house to Potiphar's house to jail to Paro's palace. The guy has, seen the world. And within that, he's seen every single strata of society. He's seen the lowlifes in jail. He's seen, you know, some middle, slavery class in Potiphar's household. He's seen now the elite in Yaakov's, in Paro's palace. And he was, again, you know, a nobility of sort in his own family. His life has really been the most consistent of all, definitely more than Yehuda's. He's always second in charge wherever he is. That does not change. He's second in charge in Yaakov's house. He's second in charge in Potiphar's house. He's second in charge in jail. He's second in charge to Paro. Yosef, you can use a colloquial phrase, he's always been a bridesmaid, never a bride. He's always second in charge. He never rises to be the top. So if we're looking at the story in this light, Yosef loses. Who does win? Yehuda. And if we look at Berachot Yaakov at the end of Sefer Bereishit, Perek Mem Tet, it's no surprise that most of Berachot Yaakov for all the other brothers is either an insult to them or just kind of describing their characteristics. Only Yosef and Yehuda get special brachot talking about their future, as Rav Hirsch comments. And although they're both singled out for greatness, Yehuda's bracha is much stronger, it's much better than Yosef's bracha. He's given memshalah, kingship, while Yosef at most is given princes, some sort of authority, but he's not going to be the head honcho as Yehuda's going to be. Why the difference? Why does Yehuda win while Yosef lags in second place? I think we can already see the foreshadowing of this response by looking at their mothers. Yosef is a descendant of Rachel, while Yehuda is a descendant of Leah. And like their mothers, their lives, I think, mirror and I think represent very similar struggles that their mothers had. Rachel is the beloved one right away. When Yaakov sees her, it's love at first sight. She doesn't have to work on his affection. She has it from the get-go. She's chosen immediately. Rav Hirsch comments on Yosef's bracha. Yaakov refers to Yosef as Ben Porat Yosef, which he explains as a noble, distinguished son is Yosef, nobility. And Rav Hirsch comments, it's no surprise that Yosef drew his nobility from his mother. His source of his nobility, of his innate sense of being elite, being respected, all came from Rachel, who had this certain sense to her. When people saw her, they liked her right away. That was Yosef. And we see that throughout Yosef's life. In Perek Lamed Tet, when he goes to Potiphar's house, he doesn't have to really do anything. We're told right away that God's with Yosef, Hashem Ito, and we're told, the Kol Asher Hu Oseh Hashem Atzeach V'Yazo, God did everything possible for Yosef, V'Yimaseh Yosef Chayim Ve'inav. Right away, he finds favor in his master's eyes. So too, in the end of Perek Lamed Tet, when he's in jail, Vayitein Chino Be'nei Sar Be'nei Sohar. Again, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't work hard. Right away, he finds favor in the person in charge of the jail, in the warden's eyes. He has this innate sense of nobility and respect that he gets as soon as people meet him. Leah, on the other hand, always had to work hard for her affection. Each one of her children's names reflects the ongoing struggle that she tried and she worked on to gain Yaakov's love and affection. But ultimately, she comes out victorious. She has 6 children, while Rachel only has 2. Most of the Shvatim, or at least half the Shvatim, come from her. She outlives her sister. She's buried with Yaakov, Ma'arat HaMachpelah, while Rachel is buried somewhere on the way. She does come out victorious at the end. She had a struggle, she had a lot of pain in her life, but at the end of the day, her end result perhaps is more fulfilling than Rachel's life. And I think you can see a future example of this struggle in future generations as well, where David is a descendant of Leah versus Shaul, who is a descendant of Rachel from Binyamin. The same idea of like inherent nobility versus someone who has to work and struggle at it. Shaul has this inheritance of nobility, while David is a little bit more of a commoner. He works on himself. He's more of the people. Where Michal, when she rebukes David for dancing, you know, publicly and, you know, maybe not taking care of himself and not being as distant from the people, you see those characteristics of Rachel versus Leah being carried through throughout their descendants. But I think to really understand why Yehuda wins and why Yosef loses, it's not just looking back to their mothers, but it's really comparing something that happens in their own lives. And that's comparing the largest point of similarity, which will hopefully show us the greatest point of contrast between the two characters. And that is the seduction story. Perek Lamed Chet versus Perek Lamed Tet. And I think we're going to find our answer here, why Yehuda will come out victorious and he'll end up being our leader and our ruler. Going through the story, Perek Lamed Chet, Yehuda does not at least seem to emerge as a very noble character. The Torah does not feel bad about blaming Yehuda and pointing out his flaws. So we're told Yehuda leaves his family, he marries Bathsheba, he has 3 children, And we're told in the story that where two of his sons have already died, and it's now Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar kalato, shuvi almana beit avich, ad yigadel sheila b'ni. He tells Tamar, we hear my family and my house where, as an almana, as a widow, until Sheila grows up. Ki amar pen yamutz gavu ke'achav. This is what the Torah says, what Yehuda is thinking. Yehuda is scared that he will die just like his brothers died. Yehuda does not at all have any introspection, any thought about why his sons died. What does he immediately do? He casts the blame somewhere else. It must be Tamar's fault. An outsider, she is to blame. My family is perfect. My children are wonderful. They did not die because of their own sins. While the Torah tells us explicitly the opposite. The Torah does not use the phrase that someone is bad in God's eyes and God kills them that often. But that Yehuda's two children were told that what they did was Ra b'nei Hashem by Niteyu Hashem. They were bad in God's eyes. God kills them. How oblivious could his father, Yehuda, be about his son's nature? Clearly very oblivious. He's living in his bubble of self-righteousness where he thinks his family is perfect and all fault, all blame can be pushed on somebody else, the outsider, in this case, Tamar. And likewise, when he wants to pay back the woman he went to, the prostitute, what does he do? Look at Pasuk Chaf, that he sends the payment by Yishlach Yudat Yudziha Ezim Biyad Re'ehu. He sends it with his friends, Hadulami. Lakachat Ha'arvon Miyat Yishav Elo Matzah. He wants to get back his collateral, his stuff, and pay her. Why does he send his friends? We're told, when his friend cannot find this woman, and he now has the goats in his possession, Yehuda says to his friend, you keep the payment. You keep the animals. Why? This is Pasuk Chaf Gimel. Vayomer Yehuda, Tikach La Pen Yihya Lavos. You take it because I don't want it to be an embarrassment to me. What's he worried about? His own image. He wants to maintain the image that he is righteous, he is pure, he is good. God forbid, they would find out what Yehuda did at night, and he'll be embarrassed about it. So he has his friend do the dirty work for him, and he has his friend keep the animals, so that no one should be able to point a finger back and say, Yehuda did something inappropriate. And then finally, when Yehuda finds out that Tamar is pregnant, Yehuda does not investigate the situation. He does not speak to her. He does not issue a court hearing. We're told he has his response, and it's very quickly. Vayomer Yehuda, says Pasuk Chaf Dalet, Hotzioa v'tisareiv. Take her out and burn her. He has no problem issuing someone's judgment right away. And why not? Because again, if she's the guilty one, who comes out looking innocent? Yehuda and his family. And we're told that when she's about to be sent out to be burnt, she has that, again, that famous, we've looked at this pasuk already beforehand, she has that famous phrase of hakerna, right? Recognize. Rashi has a beautiful comment on this phrase. This is now source number 11. Right? Kishalcha al-hamesh. She sends word to her father-in-law. Lo ratza lahavin panah v'lomar mimcha ani muvarech. She didn't want to say and embarrass her father-in-law and say, you're the one who made me pregnant. It was you. Rather, what does she say? Ela le'ish asher eila lo. Whoever is the owner of these items, amra im yotza me'atzmo. She says, if he's going to admit, it's coming from himself, me'atzmo, yotza. Ve'im lav, yisrafuni. If he will not admit, I'll be burned. I'm not going to make him admit. I'm not going to like call the tabloids and call him out and make everyone know that yotza is something inappropriate. Rather, I'm going to give him the opportunity and chance to admit on his own. If he admits on his own, great, then I'll be saved. If he will not have the courage to admit him on his own, then I am willing to be burned. Right? She does not uncover Yehuda publicly. Which is where that now Rashi continues. Mikan amru noach lo li adam sheyaflu lekivshana eish ve'ayad yalvin penei chaver berabin. So this is where Chazal learned the idea that it's better that you should throw yourself into a furnace than rather to embarrass your friend. But Tamar gives him the opportunity. She does not corner him and force him to admit anything. But this becomes a very important moment for Yehuda. This becomes the dramatic change in Yehuda. What is Yehuda's response? We're told in the next pasuk, Vayakir Yehuda. He recognizes the items. And Vayomar Tzadka Mimeni. She is more righteous than I am. Now, he bursts his own bubble of self-righteousness. He's not afraid of being embarrassed. He publicly now admits his sin, and this time he puts the blame on himself. He's no longer blaming Tamar, but he's actually looking inward and saying, I am at fault. She is more righteous than I am. And this marks a dramatic, dramatic change in the character of Yehudah. From this point on, Yehudah is no longer this arrogant person, but now he moves to someone who's humble. And we see that throughout the rest of the stories with his negotiations with Yosef and Yaakov, he's willing to take responsibility. The way he's able to convince Yaakov to send down Binyamin is because he says to Yaakov, I pledge to guarantee you Binyamin's safety, and if I do not, I will have sinned against you all my days. It's on my shoulders, it's my responsibility. I'm not scared of looking inward and taking blame, taking responsibility. While if we look at Yosef's seduction story in Parak Lamed Tet, none of this occurs. For the first part, Yosef never succumbs. Right? We're told day after day, Eshet Potiphar tries to seduce Yosef, but nothing's doing on Yosef's side. Our pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayehi Kayom Hazeh, Vayevo Habayit Elasok Lachto, Ve'ein Ishman Shehabayit Shababayit. There's no one home. Right? In this day where there would be no evidence, there would be no witnesses, she makes her move again. We're told by Enach, by Yetzeachusa, all these verbs. Very quickly, he leaves his garments, he runs outside. There's no hesitation. Yes, the Midrash perhaps creates a different picture, but on the Pshat level, Yosef is never tempted to succumb, and he never does. He emerges, although his reputation is tarnished, Yosef knows himself and knows that he's 100% innocent, and he never did anything wrong. Yosef is known as Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef, the pious one. While Yehudah, I think we can talk about him as something else, Yehudah is someone who has to grow in and struggle. There's a beautiful Razak which explains why our kings have to come from the background of Yehudah and other people who have skeletons in their closet. This is source number 12. But Kloha Zvarim Ha'ela, Hayot Zara Yehudah Baza Hadarach, Hayot Zavet Meirut Hamoviyah, Shalom Be'Bat Sheva. Razak is saying there's a pattern here. Kingship and kings come from these tarnished pasts. Yehudah with this relationship with Tamar, and we know that his children become the kings. David comes from Ruth HaMoaviyah, again some sort of shady background, and Shlomo comes from Bathsheba. Why? Hakol Hayas Sivat Mein Hashem. Everything was from God. This is God's plan. God wanted it this way. Shelo Yitzu Malchei Yehudah Yisrael. That the kings of Yehudah should not be haughty over the kings of Israel. Sheyizkru Sor Chatzro, that a stone should remember from which it is fashioned out of. And this will enable the kings of Yehudah to be modest and to lead their kingship, the kingdom, with modesty and pure heart. So Razak is making a very important point. Our kings have to have shady pasts, have to have, again, their skeletons in their closet in order for them themselves to maintain anivut. We don't want our kings to be super arrogant. We don't want power to totally corrupt. We want to keep them in check, and a way to keep them in check is by having them have embarrassing pasts, having them have something they had to overcome and struggle where they don't feel like they were always perfect. And this is certainly the theme which runs throughout the Torah. When the Torah describes a king, the king has three laws. He can't have too many wives, can't have too many horses, can't have too much money. Well, the recurring motif between all those laws is, why can't you have all these things? Because the Torah wants to make sure that the king remains humble, right? Modest. While I think this is certainly true that the king himself having a sense of self, and therefore he needs to have some sort of embarrassing past, I think there's even more to it. I think it's something for ourselves as well. We can't relate to people who are perfect. We can't have our only role model and our top role model be somebody who is pure, pristine, saint-like. Our leaders have to have and be human, something which we can represent and we can view ourselves within them. The Rambam talks about, in Shmona Prakim, different types of people, and he asks, is it better to be someone who never wants to sin, the chassid mu'ula, or the person who has desire to sin, but he overcomes his sin, the kolbesh at Yitzrael? That's exactly the characteristics of Yosef versus Yehudah. Yosef has tzaddik. He's perfect. Yes, he has other flaws, but when it comes to his moral integrity, his background is pristine. He never did anything wrong. He's a tzaddik. I teach high school students, so I'll give a high school example. Yosef is the high school kid who has everything going for him. He's, you know, best at academics. He's on, like, he's the star of every single team possible. He gets a 600 on his SATs. He gets into every college of his choice, full scholarship. He has everything going for him. Perfect. Yehuda is the guy, he's the comeback kid. Yehuda is the guy who had a struggle. He wasn't so good academically in the beginning, but he worked on himself, and he pulled himself through. Yehuda is human. We can relate to Yehuda. Right? Think about movies and characters and novels. We can't relate to a character who's flawless, who doesn't have problems, who doesn't have challenges that they have to overcome. We need to see ourselves in these characters. We need to relate to people who have flaws, who can work on them and overcome them, but start somewhere where they don't begin their lives perfect with everything coming out perfectly for them. And therefore, we need our leaders to be realistic people, models for us to look at. Yes, they drop the ball at times. They sin and they make mistakes because, let's be honest, we all sin and we all make mistakes. And that's a deep reason for why Yehuda is chosen to be the leader. It's precisely because he falters and because he falls, but is able to pick himself up again and say, Tzad Kami Meni. He's able to grow from the experience and become a noble leader, as opposed to Yosef, who's innate and born with these qualities within. And this pattern clearly continues throughout Jewish history, this relationship between Yosef and Yehuda. Yes, we have a role for Yosef in Jewish history. Yes, they're important. We do want people who have innate sense of nobility and have an innate sense of right or wrong and don't fall. They're going to be the VPs. Where do we see that? We have Malchut Yisrael versus Malchut Yehuda. Yes, God realizes Malchut can come from Yosef, from Yisrael, from Ephraim, from children of Yosef. But that's the secondary Malchut. They're somehow to aid Yehuda when Yehuda does inappropriate things. They're not the ideal sense of Malchut. When we talk about the future, we're not hoping for Malchut Yisrael again. That's done. We're done with that point in Jewish history. And likewise, for the very future, we have the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef has a role. It's very unclear from the text what his role is, but somehow his role is to herald in Malchut Yehuda. Malchut Yehuda will be the final, the end point. He'll be our total leader, but Yosef has some sort of leadership role in sort of aiding and helping Yehuda. So Yosefs are very important, but there are very few of Yosefs in our lives. While I think Yehuda is a character we all can relate to, and therefore I think there's a lot of hope and inspiration that we all struggle, we all fall at times, but greatness comes from those who do fall and those who learn from their mistakes and can grow from them. So we'll end with that.